Hey, 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 it is Saturday, which means it's a day that you wake up late, eat some form of sugary cereal, watch TV, and in general, just do whatever you want. The reason why I wanted to have this space is because I've been doing a lot of Twitter spaces lately professionally for other people, and I've actually never done one for myself, so I wanted to get better at it. I actually don't expect anybody to join. That is totally fine if it's just me here for the entire hour. But talk about what I want to talk about, you know, have some fun, share some clips, and whoever comes in, that will be pretty funny. So I didn't invite anybody. I didn't, you know, it's just out there, and I think I only have 500 or so followers. So I wanted to make sure that some of this stuff worked, and that I've got interesting stuff to play via the computer. I'll be playing like some stand-up comedy and stuff like that. And I just wanted to see if it works. You know, this is mostly for audio testing purposes and to have fun and to do strange words on Saturday. So I will be back in 1 second and hope that helps. In fact, we're going to see here for about a couple minutes or so whether my connection to the computer here works and whether you can hear this kind of waiting music, you know, in between silences. This is from the Chilled Kongs playlist. It's lo-fi. It's the Chilled Kongs Lo-Fi Coffee Shop, and that is a project on Cardano. Big into Cardano NFTs at the moment. I can talk more about that in a second. But first of all, let's see if this music comes through as a sort of, you know, waiting room so it doesn't have to be empty silence. Thank you. Alrighty, that was Dave Renda with I Got This, once again from the Chilled Kongs playlist. That's a project on Cardano. If you want to check out that project, it's on jpeg.store. No idea if that music came through in the mix. It looked like it did on the soundboard, and it looks like it's connected correctly, but I guess we'll have to see whether it's coming through on the road, but it's not coming through on Twitter Spaces. So, hey, that's fine. So as I said, yeah, the Chilled Kongs is not a Cardano NFT that I own. I just know that it is one of the top collections there on the good old JPEG store. And if you haven't heard of JPEG store, it is essentially the OpenSea of Cardano. It is literally JPEG, like the, well, without the E, jpeg.store. And that will take you to the website, buy, sell, and create digital collectibles, discover artwork, support creators, and join communities on a decentralized blockchain. That decentralized blockchain is known as the old Cardano. Interesting, they're minting Cardano punks again. So if you go down to the middle of the page and you look at top collections and then you then sort for all time, Chilled Kongs comes up as the sixth collection. It has 17.3 million ADA in trading volume. It has 8,888 unique items. Almost 3K owners. The floor price is 1,710 ADA, which is fascinating. That is approximately $718. So nothing too terribly crazy. Just like you see on OpenSea. But, I mean, keep in mind, there are collections on Cardano that are going into the many thousands of dollars and even millions of dollars. I'm not sure how much those are selling because Cardano is still not a well-adopted NFT ecosystem, even though it should be, but that is there. The top collection on Cardano is actually Space Buds. We will go here to all-time Space Buds. Trading volume of 40.1 million ADA. The floor is 4,800, which for context is a little bit over $2,000 at the moment. But if we go back to that collection and we sort by all prices, sorry, we sort high to low, the top selling Space Bud, you know, once again, it hasn't sold yet, but it's listed for sale now, is 810K Cardano, which is approximately $340,000. So, and somebody has a top offer of 25 ADA on it, which is like $2. I should make an offer of 50 ADA. I wonder what its price history is. Its price history, interesting. Nobody's actually even traded it yet. Somebody just listed it for 810 a couple of months ago. They wanted to be on the top of the list like I do. I've done that sometimes for Cardano NFTs. Just list something that you bought for 5 ADA for a ridiculous price because you want, when somebody sorts high to low, you want them to be like, oh my gosh, is this really the way it is? So anyways, the entire reason why you heard that song, and once again, hopefully that song came through, maybe you're just wondering, no, we just heard Silence, is because of the Chilled Kongs collection on Cardano. And, you know, these NFTs, they've all got their kind of ecosystems, right? They've all got their merch, their communities, you know, people on their relative social media. And Chilled Kongs was one of the few that I saw that they said, oh, we've got all these playlists to go along with their lore. And usually I'm not very bullish on listening to somebody else's playlist because I don't know. I tend to... Curated music is always kind of hard for me. There tends to be more that I dislike than I like. But every so often, if somebody knows me well, or if you're listening to like a best of or a compilation of, you can find some good stuff in there. You can find some bangers. So I just went for it off of a whim. And I think what attracted me to it was lo-fi. I used to be a big fan of Mac DeMarco, if you've ever heard of Mac DeMarco. And I kind of fell behind on lo-fi music. I just wasn't listening to a lot of music in general. I'm more of a podcast guy these days. I like the information, and I'm a little bit more productive than relaxed these days. Maybe I should change that. But Yeah, I went and found this playlist for Chilled Kongs, and they don't just have this one for coffee shop. They've got another one for the hammock. They've got another one for a cabin. They've got a decent amount of playlists. Hammock. Yeah, hammock, cabin, and something else. Anyways, you can go to their website, too, and also look at it. I found it to be phenomenally relaxing. I mean, I've listened to all these playlists at least more than twice, probably more than three times, and they're all at least 1 hour long. So I, you know, just thought that I'd share it with you there. They got wood cabin, they got hammock, they got coffee shop, and I think that's it. So three playlists of 40 something minutes each. They only have 319 subscribers on YouTube. Interesting. Got to get those numbers up, baby. Got to get those numbers up. So assuming, and I'm making a big assume here, you know what happens when you assume, or you start assuming, I'm sorry, you make an ass out of you and Ming. And now you're saying, I understand the ass part, but who is Ming? Well, Ming is my Chinese friend, so please, stop being racist. assuming that the music went through, I am now going to play you a little clip from the old comedian Doug Stanhope. I was thinking today about the concept of tradition. What was I watching? Oh, I was trying to watch Chocolat with Johnny Depp because I recently had watched the movie I Love You Man from Judd Apatow. I hadn't seen that movie in forever. Great comedy movie. And there's a joke in there that Paul Rudd references where he says, yeah, the greatest time that I ever had with my fiance is splitting a bottle of wine, making a summer salad, and watching Chocolat. And of course, I can't remember who the other guy is. And Jason Segel? There you go. How did I know that? I can't remember. Jason Segel says, you know, you should be ashamed of yourself. And I thought, you know, that's one of those movies, Chocolat, with Johnny. It has a major actor in it, Johnny Depp. It's from around the 2000s, I believe, the early 2000s, maybe even late 90s. I just thought, like, I've never watched the movie. I have nothing against it. I'll watch pretty much any movie. Anybody in my life knows that I will, you know, ask my brother, I will watch pretty much any movie, even a bad movie, because as What's-His-Name used to say, Martin Scorsese, the way you figure out how a movie is good or not is by watching a lot of bad movies. Kind of similar to how, oh gosh, what's his name? William Faulkner would say that if you want to learn how to write, you should read everything. You should read, you know, you should not only read great books, you should read pulp magazines, you should read billboards, you should read, you know, smut and filth, you should read the back of cereal boxes. Everything that is a form of writing will teach you about writing. So I wanted to watch this movie, Chocolat, and in Chocolat, it's basically a movie set in the 1950s about a little French town and this woman who's like, I don't know, like an atheist, it's just basically like a woman who's a nonconformist, which in the 50s would have been a huge deal, sets up this little chocolate shop. Anyways, I haven't finished it. I only watched like 20 minutes of it, and I know I'm going to finish it, but I had to go out for a walk, and then of course I had to do this space. I'd committed to it, this, that, and the other. And so it's, you know, it's been fun. It got me thinking, though, about the concept of tradition. And whenever I think about the concept of tradition, one of Doug Stanhope's greatest bits, Doug Stanhope is perhaps the greatest living comedian right now. Maybe it's also Tim Dillon. I don't know. There's just so many. I'm just going to go with Doug Stanhope for the simplicity of it. Doug Stanhope has this great bit from his special No Refunds in which he talks about how tradition is dead people's baggage, and you should just drop it. So assuming that this comes through on YouTube like I want it to, I'm also going to play this clip. It's about 5 minutes long, and we will adjust for volume.
Nationalism does nothing but teach you how to hate people that you never met, and all of a sudden, you take pride in accomplishments you had no part in whatsoever, and you brag about. You know. Like the Americans would go, fuck the French. Fuck the French. If we hadn't have saved their ass in two world wars, they'd be speaking German right now. You go, oh, was that us? That was us? Was that me and you, Tommy? We saved the French? Jesus. I know I blacked out a little bit after that fourth shot of Jägermeister last night, but I don't remember. I know we went through the Wendy's drive-thru. We're going to get one of them fresh cheddar sandwiches. It looked so alluring on the commercial, but then we ordered it and realized we had no money and we had to ditch out before the second window. And those douchebags in line behind us with the bass music probably got our order and out. We laughed about that, but I don't remember saving the French at all. I went through the last 10 calls on my cell phone, and there's nothing incoming or outgoing to the French looking for muscle on a project. I checked my pants. There's no mud stains on the knees from where we were garroting krauts in the trenches at Verdun. I think we didn't do anything but watch sports bloopers while we got hammered. I think we should shut the fuck up. All that stuff, tradition and heritage, it's dead people's baggage. Quit carrying it. Did you make it up? No. It's passed on to me. Pass it back. Every immigration argument that you hear, they never come from how does it affect you personally? Well, you know, these immigrants, they come to our country, they burden our tax system. What they do is they come here and they get into our education system and our health care, and I got to pay the tax. My taxes have to pay that. Well, what the fuck are you doing to me? Every time you have a kid because it's American, I should pull up a chaise lounge and wave a flag while 15 of those things come out of you, pay every... Oh, I can't wait to pay for these. They're American. I have a vasectomy and an abortion on my record, but I can't wait for all your fucking fat-headed Midwestern kids to come out of you. What are you, Catholic? Come on, be fruitful and multiply. Love it, love it. I'll get a second job. No, keep... Well, these immigrants, they don't speak the language. Then don't talk to them. Well, I solved your problem. That was quick. You know who speaks the language perfectly? Your next door neighbor. You've lived there 8.5 years. You've never said one fucking word to that guy. You avert eye contact should you check the mail at the same time. So why would you give a shit what the guy selling gnip gnops in a cart in the park speaks? It's none of your fucking business. And all the cliched arguments like that, well, they're lazy, they're shiftless, and they're criminals and all this. All those arguments go against the main cliched argument of their taking American jobs. I live on the Mexican border. I live 7 miles off the Mexican border in a town, Bisbee, Arizona, a little town. I can go out any day and watch Border Patrol arresting these guys by the dozen, 11 at a time out of a Dodge Omni, like a clown car with plastic cuffs. And you're right, they don't speak the language and they probably have no education. They don't have fucking shoes half the time. They're like barefoot and tattered castaway, like Gilligan's Island shorts, and like a dirty t-shirt, and they're dehydrated and wandering a desert for 4 days. And if that guy is as qualified for your job as you are, you're a fucking loser of such epic, humiliating proportions. I would be ashamed to have anyone find out that guy took my job. He doesn't speak English. What, did they do your job training in pantomime, shithead? Oh, see it coming? Poink, poink? I see it, poink, poink. Crank, 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 crank. You're out of here, mullet head. That guy's more qualified. Fucking asshole, you should have tried harder. Nobody bitches about immigrants taking their job if that person has skills of any level. No, they're fucking brain surgeons sitting around the Beverly Hills Hotel lounge. You know what really chaps my ass, Barry? Scandinavian fellas are coming over taking all our good neurosurgery positions. The Norwegians specifically. I say we down ourselves a bottle of Jack Daniels and go stomp us some Ouija ass. The first Ouija we see, we jump out of that Explorer and pound him. Fucking immigrants. All started with that Einstein. Once they brought him over from Germany and we didn't have any good genius jobs, it was a trickle-down effect.
Oh, yes, the great Doug Stanhope, the living prophet of anything, I don't even want to say controversial, but the craft of how he talks about such fascinating, complex, interesting things, and has never been canceled for it, as far as I know. Not, nor should he be. He also wrote some great books as well, two of them as well. Helped his own mom commit suicide in a rather humorous fashion, and I just cannot sing the praise of the guy high enough. He also has a podcast, although I have not listened to it in quite a long time. Quite a long time. Interesting thing is that somebody actually came into this space while we were playing that clip. I want to say his name was Mohan, or maybe it was Muhammad, and he was here for about 5 seconds before he dipped out. I'm assuming it was a he. So, you know, Doug Stanhope ain't for everybody, people. He ain't for everybody. But I loved what he said there about, you know, tradition being dead people's baggage. It's passed on to you. Go ahead, pass it back. Not that I'm, you know, some crazy person who's like, oh, all tradition is bad and you shouldn't do anything in your tradition. I just think he, you know, of course, and comedians have the best way of doing this. They have the best way of flipping something on its head or taking the clothes off of something and presenting it to you stark naked and saying, this is what it is. Agree with it or not, but isn't this funny? And my answer is always, hell yes. Hell yes. If you've never been to a comedy club, I would suggest going to one, even if it's a really shitty one. Like, let's say you're living somewhere, you know, I know Florida is known for having really shitty comedy clubs. Probably, you know, Nebraska. And I'm not shitting on these states. Every state has something interesting about it, and every state has something fucking terrible about it. So don't get your panties in a bunch here. But if you have never been to a live comedy club, it is most definitely an experience. You'll never escape the two-drink minimum. You might also have to buy food. You might also have to get tickets on top of that. But to me, at least personally, it is worth it. It's kind of like seeing a play, or it's kind of like seeing a first run of a movie. It's just a special and interesting experience that it's hard to replicate, and it's not the same as listening to comedy albums, and it is most definitely not the same as watching it, the special on TV. There's something about the screen where you're watching somebody versus watching in person that with laughter doesn't translate. Maybe, I mean, honestly, maybe a good example or a good analogy is pornography, right? Everybody knows that watching such a crazy act on a screen does not compare with actually, I don't even care if you're a participant or not, having that happen in front of you. In the same way that at Instagram, you know, you see somebody's Instagrammed photo of food, but you can't taste it, smell it. Once again, even if you're not interacting with it, just having the actual food in front of you. So I love Doug Stanhope. I'll always love Doug Stanhope. In fact, let's play one more clip from him before I try and move on to some other stuff. And I don't expect, once again, I don't expect anybody to join this space. I know it's just me talking, yapping, having fun. If other people want to join, I didn't promote this at all. I didn't invite anybody at all. I'm just trying to make sure that the audio comes through clear, that I have a whole handle on the Twitter space model, and that I know exactly what I'm doing for the future. This is a skill, people. It's a skill. So we are going to listen to one more Doug Stanhope clip before we move on to other stuff. And this one is called On Freedom.
I mean, you're born absolutely free, except for laws of nature. Those, if you drink, you get drunk. That's a law. If you If you get old, you die. That's a law, too. If you sit on a tack, you will bleed from the ass. These are the only laws that you're born with, and any government just fucks you out of that type of freedom. If you really think you're free tonight, you, hero, officer bomb, you're a free man. You live in a free country, but you go upstairs, you take your own beer you risked your life for. You sit on the hood of your monster truck in the parking lot. Drink your beer and see how long it is before actual veteran cops come by and pound on you with truncheons on the kidneys to show, why can't I do it? I'm just having a beer. I don't know. That's the law, though. You don't fuck around. You can't drive down the street without a seatbelt on. Why not? I don't know. You're going to put on a helmet. You can't sit in your own backyard naked, your own filthy, dirty flesh that you're born with. You know that body you carry around? Filthy. You can't sit out. Why not? I don't know. That's just the way it is. Mother! You're not free. You're not free in the least. You need a diploma in this country to cut hair. You're free. You need to keep your tray in an upright and locked position during takeoff. It's not just a hack premise. It's a fucking felony. And Cunty the Hero Sky Cunt will fucking throw you off the plane as a terrorist for going, why do I have to have this? This doesn't make sense. They say if you give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day. But if you teach a man to fish, then he's going to get a fishing license, but he doesn't have any money. So he's going to get a job, and he has to get into the Social Security system and pay taxes. And now you're going to audit the poor cocksucker because he's not really good with math. You pull the IRS van up to your house, he'll take all your shit. He'll take your Black Velvet Elvis and your Batman toothbrush and your penis pump, and that all goes up for auction with the burden of proof on you because you forgot to carry the one because you were just worried about eating a fucking fish, and you couldn't even cook the fish because you needed a permit for an open flame. And then the health department is going to start asking you a lot of questions about where are you going to dump the scales and the guts. This is not a sanitary environment. And ladies and gentlemen, if you get sick of it all at the end of the day, not even legal to kill yourself in this country. Thanks again, John Ashcroft, you weird Bible addict, can't even handle his own drug. You were born free, you got fucked out of half of it, and you wave a flag celebrating.
Oh, gosh. How could you not like Doug Stanhope? I could see if you see these a little bit crude, and you say, oh, I wish it was a little bit more like Jerry Seinfeld, didn't cuss so much, and blah, but he just, man. The thing that is most important in comedy, at least to me, is you tell the truth, and you make it funny. Sounds easy, but there's probably nothing harder in the world, isn't there? Sounds easy, but there's probably nothing harder in the world. Moving on, and of course, assuming that you heard any of that, I want to talk a little bit about another one of my interests. You know, I like comedy. Of course, I like being outside. I live in the great state of Colorado here. It says that on my Twitter profile. I work for a crypto company. I won't specify that just yet. I've been into Bitcoin since 2017 or so, and I've got the Coinbase transaction history to prove it. I'm a buyer and I'm a holder. And, you know, we're speaking about truth here. We're speaking about kind of having fun with the world, which I consider, when you combine truth and comedy, I think actually what you get a lot of time is innovation. Maybe I'm crazy for thinking that. Maybe you're saying, nah, that's not true. Okay, fine. You can disagree with me. And if anybody else comes into this space other than that one guy, hey, you can speak up whenever you want to. Won't silence you or anything like that. So far, it's only been that one guy. But this kind of brings up an interesting thing. So Bitcoin, which is one of my favorite cryptocurrencies, I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist. It's just happens to be my favorite. One of my first loves, and of course I've done the research and really gone down the deep dive kind of rabbit hole about why Bitcoin is such a unique and fascinating technology. However, one of the more interesting things about Bitcoin is that it has this lore behind it. And I don't mean a lore in the sense of a NFT project lore where it's created and there's a company behind it or, you know, some sort of manufactured product. I guess it is it's a human-made product for sure, but the like lore behind Bitcoin is almost mystical. It's almost magical and religious, if you would want to think about it that way. And that is because it was created by a person or persons named Satoshi Nakamoto, in case you're not aware of this. Now you're asking, okay, sounds like a Japanese person. Could be. Nobody has any idea. Satoshi Nakamoto not only practiced amazing cybersecurity and cyber privacy, but they disappeared before Bitcoin became the kind of Coca-Cola of cryptocurrencies. It has incredible brand name recognition. You know, if this is the first time you're hearing about it, don't feel too left out, but just know that you're in like the last maybe 25% of people that haven't heard of it. And I'd be very surprised if me saying the word Bitcoin piqued your interest to the point where you're like, I've never heard of that at all. That would, especially if you're on Twitter. Anyways, Satoshi Nakamoto being the inventor of this unique technology, similar to the internet, free and open source. And nobody knows who they, he, she, it, it may be an alien. Nobody knows the identity of Satoshi Nakamoto. And this is not only fascinating just strictly from a lore and mystery perspective, but it becomes more fascinating that Bitcoin continually becomes adopted, appreciates in price, the technology hasn't broken, the technology has been actively improved upon, and people always describe it as a sort of virginal birth of a technology, which is extremely rare in the technology world. Maybe you could also say that that happened with the internet, but the fact is we know who invented the internet. It was Tim Berners-Lee, along with some other collaborators. So I guess you could also say it was the United States Department of Defense from ARPANET, but that's besides the point. A technology such as Bitcoin that works as it does, is continually improved, has people building on it, has an incredible market capitalization, even in this depressed market. Current price of Bitcoin as I'm recording this is, okay, now it's 20,800 and some change. It's a little bit up from this morning. You know, the highest it's been is 69,000 back in November of 2021. I've seen it during this cycle go to, I think, as low as 17 or 18. But once again, price predictions are besides the point. We're talking about Satoshi Nakamoto here. The legend and the lore of Satoshi Nakamoto, who they are, how they built this amazing thing, it will always be discussed. It will always be amazing. But it's also more interesting to hear how this kind of permeates out into the culture and what people think about it in relation to Bitcoin or in learning about Bitcoin. And so I wanted to have a clip here from the Lex Fridman podcast, in case you're not familiar with it, where he's interviewing Michael Saylor. Michael Saylor, in case you don't know, is the CEO of a company. Well, actually, he's no longer CEO anymore, but he was the CEO of a company called MicroStrategy, which is a data, essentially a data analytics company. And he's become a huge, huge Bitcoin bull, mostly for economic reasons. And we're not going to dive too deep into that. But just know that he loves Bitcoin and he is sufficiently educated on Bitcoin as any other Bitcoiner that you'd know, any other real Bitcoiner that you know, I should say. And what I mean by real Bitcoiner is just somebody that has taken the time to understand all of the technology so they know what it is and what it isn't. That's it. You can still not like it if you want to. Perfectly fine with me. Not about to force anybody's hand or try and change anybody's opinion on this. Anyways, they talk about here in this clip, it's about almost 6 minutes long, who is Satoshi Nakamoto, the kind of legend in the lore, and I think that it is another kind of interesting, mental-stimulating moment in the same way that if Doug Stanhope is funny, then this is curious in a different way. So let's listen.
One of the fascinating things about Bitcoin, and sorry to romanticize certain notions, but Satoshi Nakamoto, that the founder is anonymous. Maybe you can speak to whether that's useful, but also I just like the psychology of that, to imagine that there's a human being that was able to create something special and walk away. So first, are you Satoshi Nakamoto?
I'm certain I'm not.
No,
Actually, I think the provenance is really important. And if I were to look at the highlighted points, I think having a founder that was anonymous or pseudonymous is important. I think the founder disappearing is also important. I think that the fact that the Satoshi coins never moved is also important. I think the lack of an initial coin offering is also important. I think the lack of a corporate sponsor is important. I think the fact that it traded for 15 months with no commercial value was also important. You know, I think that the simplicity of the protocol is very important. I think that the outcome of the block size wars is very important. And all of those things add up to common property. They're all indicia, indicators of a digital property as opposed to security. If there was a Satoshi sitting on top of $50 billion worth of Bitcoin, I don't think it would cripple Bitcoin as property, but I think it would undermine its digital property. And if I wanted to undermine a crypto asset network, I would do the opposite of all those things. I would launch one myself. I would sell 25% or 50% to the general public. I would keep some of the initial, I would pre-mine some stuff or early mine it, you know, and I would keep an influence on it. Those are all the opposite of what you would do in order to create common property. And so I see the entire story as Satoshi giving a gift of digital property to the human race and disappearing.
Do you think it was one person? Do you have ideas of who it could be?
I don't care to speculate.
Okay. But do you think it was one person?
I think it was one person. Maybe in conjunction with a bunch of others. I mean, it might have been a group of people that were working together, but certainly there's a Satoshi.
I mean, it's just so fascinating to me that one person could be so brave and thoughtful. Or do you think a lot of his accent, like the block size wars, the decision to make a block a certain size, all the things you mentioned led up to the characteristics that make Bitcoin property. Do you think that's an accident or was it deeply thought through? Like this is almost like a history of science question.
People tried it they tried 40 of them, right? I mean, I think there's a history of attempting to create something like this, and it was tried many, many times, and they failed for different reasons. And I think that it's like Prometheus tried to start a fire 47 times, and maybe the 48th time it sparked. And that's how I see this. This is the first one that sparked. And it sets a roadmap for us. And I think, if you're looking for any one word that characterizes, it's fair, right? The whole point of the network is it's a fair launch, a fair distribution. Like, yeah, I have Bitcoin, but I bought it. In fact, at this point, we've paid $4 billion of you real cash to buy it. If I was sitting on the same position and I had it for free, then there's always this question of, did I pay, or I bought it for a nickel a coin or a penny a coin? The question is, was it fair? And that's a very hard question to answer, right? Did you acquire the Bitcoin that you own fairly? And if you roll the clock back, you could have bought it for a nickel or a dime, but that was when it was a million times more likely to fail. Mm-hmm. Right. When the risk was greater, the cost was lower. And then over time, the risk became lower and the cost became greater. And the real critical thing was to allow the marketplace, absent any powerful interested actor. Right. It's almost like if Satoshi had held a million coins and then stayed engaged for 10 more years, tweaking things in the background, there'd still be that question. But what we've got is really a beautiful thing. We've got a chain reaction in cyberspace, or an ideology spreading virally in the world that has seasoned in a fair, ethical fashion. Sometimes it's a very violent, brutal fashion with all the volatility, right? And there's been a lot of sound and fury along the way.
So that was Michael Saylor and the great Lex Fridman. both talking about the legend of Satoshi Nakamoto, the Bitcoin network being free, fair, and open to investment. Sorry, it's not free. Like I said, it's 20K a Bitcoin right now. But that should be cheap if you actually believe in the network. I'm not going to go on a whole Bitcoin tangent here. I just think it's fascinating to hear two people talk about the launch of a technology, especially a technology that's become a primarily financial technology, and the lore and the beginnings of it that is unlike pretty much anything else that we've seen in the world. I'd actually like to also touch on somebody who was also on the Lex Fridman podcast, Charles Hoskinson, the leader, and I don't want to say the leader, but I guess technically he is right now, of Cardano, a project that we talked about at the beginning of this space, where I was talking about the NFT collections and Shield Kongs and stuff like that related to it. That because what you'll see in the cryptocurrency space, if you get into cryptocurrency, if you really like cryptocurrency, is that there are people that are kind of OGs. And by OGs, I don't mean me from 2017. I mean real OGs, like from 2012, 2013. You know, Bitcoin has been around since 2009. Nobody knew about it in 2009. Satoshi was the only one mining those coins in 2009. They haven't moved. You can go look them up on the blockchain. There's plenty of places that document that. I don't need to get into it here. But when you talk about somebody like Charles Hoskinson, the founder of Cardano and the, you know, quote, leader of Cardano, or when you're talking about Vitalik Buterin, the leader and, quote, you know, founder, along with many co-founders of Ethereum, the second largest cryptocurrency, you're talking about people that know how the space has ebbed and flowed and innovated and not innovated and things of that nature. And so their opinion is fascinating for me to hear. Michael Saylor is an outsider to the cryptocurrency world, but he is certainly not an outsider to the financial world, the investment world, the business world. The man is 50-something years old and some change. You may not like what some people have to say about the way that the world works or their opinions on some things, and that's totally fine. I'm not trying to force my opinion on you, nor do I think anybody should force their opinions on others. But when you take in all the information and when you can verify the information or when you can figure out what's true and what's biased and what's a good thing to think about and what's not worth pursuing, then you can take it all in and just make a decision for yourself. And that's always the main goal of me taking in information, playing clips like this. You know, that's why I like having the title of this space being called Strange Words on Saturday. Because, you know, some of these words might be strange to you. You might not have heard some of these things. That's okay. You can take them in, and if you don't like them, hey, discard it. If you like them, maybe it piques your interest and you learn more about different things, and then you upgrade, you learn, you become a better version of yourself. So strange words doesn't always mean bad, just means strange. So before we play some stuff by Charles Hoskinson, I want to play a piece of music that for some reason popped into my head, and I'm not a huge fan of these guys. It's not something that like I have to hear, but I mean, hey, it's on YouTube, and I used to love this song when I was like a really early teenager. It is Van Halen's Running with the Devil, and I don't know why I thought of that. Maybe it's because we were talking about like a lot of money and a lot of finance there, but yeah, I don't know. It's a good just kind of like, I don't know if it would say it's hard rock, but for the 80s, it was definitely hard rock. So let's get into it.
Yeah.
Man, how could you not like that? The old 80s hard rock there. I don't know. I just love it. I don't think I would have liked being alive during the 80s. It seems actually like a pretty terrible time. I think I would have preferred the 50s and the 60s. Then let's go into the jungle for the 70s and the 80s, and then we'll come back in the 90s, because the 90s was a lot of fun, and I know because I lived through that as a 90s kid. So just had to play that. I didn't, there's nothing, that music is not supposed to mean anything. It's not supposed to be a spiritual reference. It's, I just love that song. I think it's a song that gets you hyped up in the right way. So, as we're coming to the end of the hour here, I definitely did want to play this clip by Charles Hoskinson on the Lex Fridman podcast. Before, we were talking about Bitcoin, we were talking about, you know, that being the oldest cryptocurrency, things like that. And now I want to play you a clip from the Lex Fridman podcast with Charles Hoskinson, the leader and CEO, if you want to put that in quotations, of Cardano. I guess he is technically the CEO of Input Output Hong Kong, one of the many companies that surrounds Cardano. Something that makes Cardano different is that it has this academic and corporate approach to its development that a lot of the other blockchains do not have. So it doesn't matter if they make these things digital securities. It doesn't matter if these things lose popularity and there's no, you know, funding for them. Cardano is ready for this. And, of course, I have my friend Kalichi Ibe to thank for introducing me to Cardano. Well, I shouldn't say that. My brother is the one who introduced me to Cardano, but I ignored him, as I should not, because my brother is many times wiser than me, just in different areas. it's just the truth. But my colleague slash friend Kalichi Ibe is the one who really urged me to re-look at it, take another look at it, and take a serious look at it, since I was a fan of Bitcoin and Monero. We're not even going to talk about Monero on this podcast. That's a entirely different thing. So let's go learn from the man himself, Mr. Charles, about what is Cardano.
Can we pull back, historically speaking, and in terms of the big picture of cryptocurrency real quick, mm-hmm. and ask the question, what is Cardano? We started talking about already the consensus algorithm Cardano takes, but maybe when you look at the history books, you know, sort of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and Cardano will have one sentence. What's that one sentence going to be? And in general, what's like the vision in the context of the history of cryptocurrency? You have like this whiteboard overview video that you talk about the three generations of cryptocurrency, where Cardano is the third. So that's like five different questions, way of asking the exact same thing. You can answer however the hell you want.
You know, I always term Cardano as like a FOSS, a financial operating system, and nobody likes it, and everybody picks on me for using that term. But basically the idea is that, you know, the world runs on systems, especially the financial world. You have, you know, the BIS and SWIFT and all this other stuff. And these protocols allow you to move value around and represent things like identity and allow you to express yourself in some way. And those protocols, for the most part, work well for people in rich countries. And they don't work so well for people who aren't in rich countries. And so the point of what we do, or at least what I do and what my company does, is we think a lot about how do we build a universal protocol that does all the stuff the legacy system has, but just does it better, faster, and cheaper for all, everybody in the world. And everybody has equal access to it. You know, so it's the people's protocol. You know, you have a situation where the guy in Senegal has the same access that I do, or Bill Gates does, or someone else who's kind of higher on the spectrum of wealth and power. And so that is what we seek to achieve. But then the question is, well, is Cardano the solution? You know, is that thing? And the answer is no, because you need a lot more evolution. You need decades of evolution to kind of work your way there. And in many ways, the work is never quite done, but it's better than what came before. Why? Because you have a realization that first, the control of the system needs to be more balanced and nuanced, and it needs to be more democratic. So there's this sustainability component of, well, who's in charge and how do you pay for things? Well, the system can print its own money, so it always has the ability to have a budget. Okay, so there's a treasury idea. And then there's a voting thing. Well, the same things that allow you to move money around allow you to represent votes. So you can do e-voting with the type of system. Okay. And, you know, if you played Gnomic in the 1980s or Peter Superfan or any of these things, you can build a self-evolving system. You can actually create a game where the rules can be voted on and changed in the game itself. Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. So that exists there. And then you say, okay, well, but this thing still has to touch the legacy world. There has to be cash in and cash out and these types of things. So there's this interoperability thing. You need a Wi-Fi or a Bluetooth moment for the industry because nothing understands each other right now. There are all these chains that are blind, deaf, and dumb to each other. And then there's this thing that it has to work at a huge scale, like billions of people. And we've done that, but we've done that with large multinational trillion-dollar companies with centralized infrastructure. We've never really done that with one master protocol that somehow does it for everyone. The closest approximation is probably BitTorrent. And it's a cool protocol, but it doesn't have all the oomph necessary to do something like this. So Cardano is just our first approximation. And like any good system, we wanted it to be self-evolving. So once you get the philosophy out of where's the target of what do you want to do, then you build a community. Now it's over 1 million people strong. And that community keeps growing and they keep pushing the system in that particular direction. And what's nice about it is if you build the right philosophy within the system, it doesn't need founders. This is the great lesson of Satoshi. It doesn't need founders to be able to get there. So, if you look at the academic side, that's very decentralized. We have more than 30 different contributors for the 105 papers, and that set keeps growing. Within the next 5 years, it'll probably be 200-400 different scientists from all across the world, some from Russia and some from India, some from China and some from Japan and America and Africa and South America. And the faces change, the languages change, the cultures change, but the process stays the same. And that is a permanent organ within what we have constructed as a system. And it's the same situation entering marketplaces. Like we entered Ethiopia. What are we doing there? We have 5 million people in Ethiopia. We're getting them digital identity and we're dragging that digital identity into the system because that's the most fundamental thing of a financial operating system. You need to know who people are in order to be able to do business with them, give them credit, be able to give them economic agency and sort of thing. But once they're there, they're going to grow up with that system. They're going to deploy applications on that system. They're going to build on that system. They're going to use it every day for getting a loan or payments and so forth. And if they have pain points, what they're going to do is evolve that system to be able to mitigate and manage those particular pain points mm-hmm. to a point where the system is competitive for it. So my job is to be, we have this tagline in our company, cascading disruption. My job is to be the first domino. Just kind of knock it over and watch the cascade. Mm-hmm. And it kind of blows and blows and blows out until eventually, it gets to where we need to go. And what I was trying to think about with Cardano was how do you build the minimum viable set of tools and social processes that once we push the domino, the system will just evolve to a point where eventually it can grow to fill that need, not out of charity, but out of self-interest. Right. People want things better, faster, cheaper. You know, people want to have economic agency, especially when they lack it. Nobody wants to grow up in a world where they're unbanked and they have no access to marketplaces. They're going to seek it. Look at M-Pesa. It's a great example of that. Like cell phone minutes, they're using as a currency. So that's where we're at. And I say a few more years, I think we'll have that right minimum viable set of dynamics inside the system. And then it's inevitable, in my view, that it'll kind of grow and consume and become this concept. And what's really cool is there's competition in the systems and concepts. So China is trying to do the same thing. They're saying, how do we de-dollarize the world and create a digital yuan? So they have a very top-down notion of how to apply this technology and bring it in. And they even have an identity system they're building in parallel called social credit. We have an identity system, Atala Prism, that we're putting in. Ours is bottom-up and you own your own identity, social credit. You have no idea. You just have a number and some computer is giving it mm-hmm. to you. But they're both trying to do the exact same thing. And it's going to be this clash of cultures at some point between the open fosses and the top-down authoritarian fosses and mm-hmm. probably some Hegelian dialectic action will happen. We'll create, some sort of somewhat closed, somewhat authoritarian, libertarian utopia.
Yeah, and most likely would be AIs battling in the space of fosses. So I really like this idea of financial operating system, but what the letter F, so financial, is this just a basic mechanism with which you can have social interaction, therefore, or all kinds of interactions, therefore have an identity? Like, is F essential to this?
Yeah, because that's how people care. You need resources to survive. And, okay. You know, finances is kind of like this field of managing your resources in an intelligent way. And you could call it SoFi too, social finance. You know, the nomenclature hasn't exactly been settled for our industry, and that's fun. But basically the concept is that you have something and you want to be able to store it, transform it, trade it, and use it to survive. And the question is, what rails do you do that on? Do you do those on centralized controlled rails where there are these third parties that are, you know, basically able to live off those things, become very fat and nepotistic? Or do you want to do it on rails where there's no middleman? You have a direct relationship with whoever you're doing business. And if you invite more people to the transaction, they're middlemen of value, not necessity. Mm-hmm. And that's really I would like to say the raison d'etre of our space, that the reason we exist is to try to figure out a way to kill the middleman and try to figure out a way that we can better quantify value and transform it, move it, manipulate it. And in many ways, we've actually discovered some amazing things in the last 10 years as an industry. Like, we've kind of created the financial stem cell. This idea of a token can now is just as well be a national currency as a CBDC as it can represent a CryptoKitty. You know, the same architecture can do stuff at the nation scale, can do stuff for a 12-year-old kid in Texas. It's pretty amazing to see that.
Indeed, it is amazing. That was Charles Hoskinson talking with Lex Fridman, Charles Hoskinson being the CEO and the leader of the Cardano / ADA ecosystem. Lots of stuff you can do on there. If you haven't ever heard about Cardano, let this be your warning shot. So I've come to the end of my time here. I promised myself that I'd do 1 hour of strange words on Saturday. I didn't realize it was going to be just me playing YouTube clips and then commenting on them. But hey, for a first podcast or a first space, that's good. Had nobody join except for that one guy who dipped in for 5 seconds. And then he was like, what is this craziness? And then he dipped out. That is totally fine. I'm not going to fault him. I've been Nathan. This has been Strange Words on Saturday. I'm hoping to come back next Saturday and do the same thing. I need to practice on my Twitter spaces, and I need to make sure that all the audio and stuff is going right so these are entertaining, informative, and worth listening to. My goal and my standard is, if I wouldn't listen to them, why the fuck would anybody else? So hopefully that is good on your end. It's fine on my end, and I'm going to wish you to have a good day. And thanks for listening to some strange words on Saturday. Bye, everybody.